This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and it's the London FinTech Podcast, episode 77. Brought to you in association with Smart Pension, Synchron and Archover. And I'm delighted to be joined today by Mark Beeston, Managing Partner and Founder of FinTech VC's Illuminate Financial. Illuminate focus on capital markets FinTech, which is jolly fortunate really, as I'm here today to discuss capital markets FinTech. Mark is a long-term Citibod, having done over two decades, starting with over a dozen years trading derivatives at Deutsche Bank, as well as being COO of Business Lines and CEO of one of ICAP's Business Lines. So someone who really knows what hardcore FS is all about. A lot of fintech is B2C, as we all have smartphones in our pockets, and this has enabled the small rodents to gnaw away at dinosaurs' eggs. So far, with lots of attention, albeit I don't see any Tyrannosaurus rexes fearing for their survival yet. There are B2B fintechs, last episode's Azure being an example. But there's a category which has been touched on far less by the London FinTech Podcast, with its focus on how the world of delivering FS is changing. This is those new firms who are working to enhance the abilities of incumbent FS, whose customers are banks, insurance companies, fund managers and the like, and who are in effect disrupting not FS, but in old money, IT vendors to FS. In 2014, when the fintech world gained wide currency, many of these had great ideas, but poor sausages didn't realise that the sales cycle, and I joke not here, to get a contract for selling pencils to a mega bank is about 2 years. Illuminate's claim is, we cross the chasm between enterprise fintech, their much better categorisation than mine of what we're talking about, and the financial institutions it should serve. I can do no better than quote further where this gulf comes from. They say, regulation is increasing, the industry is deleveraging, and compliance is becoming ever stricter. Financial institutions have been slow to adopt new technologies, while vendor management and procurement processes are focused on contracting multi-million dollar enterprise solutions from billion dollar corporations. In doing so, they often overlook the innovative, lower cost and highly scalable solutions offered by newer and more entrepreneurial suppliers. Organisations know that the answers may lie in fintech, yet the ever-growing hype around the subject has made it more and more difficult to distill the signal from the noise. All of which definitely resonates deeply with me. My main challenge in fintech is cutting through all the bullshit to find out what is really happening, and it's this essential link that I bring to my consultancy clients. Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi, Mark. Thanks for joining me today.
Hi, Mike. Thank you very much for having me.
So you were mentioning briefly motor cars, as I always like to discuss things that aren't fintech. I was mentioning briefly that I went to see Russell Brand last night, but he didn't mention motor cars. So tell me about motor cars.
Well, I think cars are my passion. Obviously, you know, fintech is what I'm known for these days, but cars have run deep in my life. My parents would tell you, since I was old enough to sit on a pushabout, my early investment strategy was definitely, if I had some spare capital, park it in the garage. Certainly a model that actually has served me quite well. It's been an interesting asset class over the last decade in its own right. But for me, I love cars of all sorts. I'm the guy that got a taxi driver to let me drive his taxi while he drove my car home from the station because I'd never had the opportunity to try driving a taxi.
Oh, brilliant. That's quite a good story, actually. Well, I'm very fortunate when it comes to cars. I mean, I'm a bit more utilitarian about them in that, going back to Top Gear as was and the Grand Tour as is, their criterion of a real car person is somebody whose first car was an Alfa, and I owned a sort of a rusty little, not too rusty, slightly rusty Alfa Sud when I lived in central London in Maid de Vale, which had a lovely flat four boxer engine.
Yep.
Everything else sort of fell apart and the petrol locking cap didn't work. Minor matters like that.
I dare say a little rusty when you got it and a little more rusty when you sold it.
Yes, yes, but lovely to drive. So in terms of your extensive career doing very remunerative things like sort of trading derivatives and CEOing and COOing and all that kind of stuff, presumably you had a fleet of Ferraris and now you're back in sort of startup land. Presumably you're back with Alfa Suds, are you?
Normally there's a few things kicking around. And one way I've managed to disguise what's in my garage at any given moment was that the original business I actually set up, even when back in my trading days, was I actually established a car dealership. So it's a constantly revolving door. But again, it's not about the individual car. For me, you know, the most exciting car is the next one. And as much as I love cars, I'm also a very, very big believer in using the right tool for the job, which actually, I guess, is also something that then comes back through to what we do in business. So yeah, I drive an Audi Estate. It might be a 560 horsepower Audi Estate.
You're the fastest person out of Tesco's car park.
Exactly.
There's, of course, a lot of overlap between cars and fintech for some reason, also cars and FS. We'll come back to the cars and the FS. But in terms of cars and fintech, most notably, of course, Giles Andrews, who pretty much created fintech globally by setting, well, he didn't actually set up Zopa, but he was one of the earliest CEOs of Zopa in about 2005. I mean, he'd had a successful car dealership before that and moved on to it. And as I mentioned once or twice recently, because we've been talking about insurance, Angus Dent, the CEO of one of my sponsors, Archover, is chairman of AMORC, Aston Martin Owners Racing Club. So right. If you don't know him, and if you've got a spare Aston Martin you don't mind sort of doing the doldrums with and driving round and round in circles, I'll put you guys together. But getting back to FS and how it's changed, I mean, you've done a couple of decades and I've done 3 decades. I knew that the whole thing was kind of getting out of hand in old money speak when the head of corporate finance at Klein Watts, and this is probably getting on for sort of late 90s, started collecting Ferraris, you know, and getting ever bigger garages, and yeah. I got to a dozen or something like that, you know, about the time that sort of Dresden of Wasserstein and all that kind of thing. So, yes, all a bit mad, but presumably you just come on the tube or Uber it to work, do you?
Actually, I'm in the fortunate position that in London, I live about 10 minutes from the office. Unfortunately, that's a 6-minute increase on where our first office was, so it's all moving in the wrong direction. But again, back to the point about using the right tool for the job. I came in from St Pancras this morning on the tube because, you know, if you want to get across London, that's the way you do it.
Indeed. So connecting FS and earning the money for your little hobby and fintech at the moment. So I mentioned sort of briefly the career journey. I mean, just as sort of an individual, but also professionally, what kind of things leap to the front of your mind that you sort of took away from having done those 20 years?
I think the journey is something that you kind of look back on. And I'm not a millennial who's planning my journey every 3 months at a time. So you get 20 or 25 years into it, in my case, and you look back behind you, and it's only then that you can kind of see, oh, I've been on a journey. The real aha moment for me was 2005, when, as a result of the derivatives documentation crisis that blew up at that time, I chose to leave Deutsche on sabbatical, join the exco of Creditex, and effectively step into the entrepreneur's shoes and launch a company called T0, which is now IceLink.
And IceLink, for the people who haven't heard of IceLink, is...
It's a CDS, credit default swap processing platform, not dissimilar to what a MarketWire was doing for interest rate derivatives. So really designed to help speed up the documentation process and, most importantly, surface errors before they become very expensive errors. The aha moment in that, for me, was this sudden realization from the entrepreneurial side of the fence. My goodness, was it really this difficult to sell me something that I desperately needed when I was that guy at the bank? And of course, the answer to that was yes, it was. And sadly, that's kind of the gift that keeps on giving in terms of self-realization.
Yes, I went indie in 1998 and I set up basically a fintech of this nature, a capital markets fintech. I created a strategic management tool, which I sold to the likes of David Robbins, the CEO of ING Bearings and Flemings and Abbey National Treasury and all that kind of thing. So I found out myself the sales B2B journey about selling to large firms. And when I left, there were, I didn't know, about over a dozen merchant banks in London. And I literally wrote down the list.
Yes.
And I went around them one by one. And the scale and size of those organisations and basically the modus operandi in those days was that actually I could meet a CEO like you, and I'd say, look, this is what it does, da-da-da-da-da, and you'd say, that's a load of rubbish, bugger off and never come back again. Or you'd say, oh, that's really interesting. Or you'd say, well, I'm not quite sure, that's another chat. And actually, you could get to a decision process fairly soon. And I remember being immensely frustrated that back in those days, from a CEO saying yes to actually getting the ink on the paper was like a 3 to 6 months process.
Yes.
But now that's sort of far faster than when you're dealing with organisations that have got vast organograms and all around the world. So the pain you're identifying is very real. I just wonder whether anybody in this space could possibly be in it unless they've got some sort of kind of masochism or they were sort of terribly bad in a previous life, because it can be a very arduous journey to have something that's wonderful and then spend 2 or 3 years trying to sell it into a large organisation. Now, of course, one of the things that you do at Illuminate is try and oil that mechanism and make it sort of smoother, but there must be a bit of masochism, isn't it, mustn't there?
I think, as with most things in life, if you know what you're getting into, then you're making that choice. This is a land of opportunity. The things that make these organizations difficult to sell to, whether that's lack of clarity of who the ultimate decision maker is, or increasingly in these risk-averse times, lack of clarity over how broadly the decision has to be syndicated, through to potentially hugely painful procurement processes even once a decision has been made. This is well documented. You shouldn't be going into it as an entrepreneur if you're not prepared for that journey. The flip side of that journey is that it makes your product ultimately potentially quite sticky and thus ultimately potentially quite valuable.
Yes, I mean, I think, you know, the squaring the circle there is a lot of what I'm talking about is 2014. In 2014, I did lots of sort of free mentoring and all this kind of thing, just being a sort of generally nice and helpful guy. And I met a whole bunch of folks who were in the tech fintech, in the capital markets fintech end of the spectrum, and I gave them lots of useful advice, which they sort of mostly didn't follow, which is what happens when you give people free advice. And, you know, I watched them over the next sort of year, 18 months, struggle and crash precisely for those reasons. Yes. Whereas now, fast forwarding in 2017, anybody who's going to enter this B2B space serving incumbents in FS will have heard on the grapevine that it ain't easy, and we'll come on to Illuminate in a minute, and firms like yours facilitate the journey. So I get the point about the stickiness, and I'm just wondering in terms of not painting everybody with the same brush. I mean, it's very easy to use a category like FS incumbents.
Yes.
And imply that there's like a circle and they all fit in that circle, but actually there's sort of multi-dimensional spectra here. And taking the example of a couple of podcasts ago, Munich Re, you know, they're a vast reinsurer with a sort of trillion gazillion dollars of capital behind them, but they've chosen to go down the route of setting up a specific, shall we say, docking port.
Yep.
To interface between sort of mega cos and reinsurers about as sort of hardcore as it can possibly get, and those people who, if they've actually got to wait 2 years to make the first sale, will probably sort of die of hunger in the meantime.
Yes.
So if you look within FS, one of the things that's actually changing, even if every innovative, disruptive, or the funny words like that, fintech disappeared overnight, one of the things that is changing is that some incumbents are adapting themselves one way or another,
yes,
faster than other incumbents,
yes,
changing the competitive landscape within incumbents. So from your perspective, let's say I resurrect my Stratos project and I come to you and I say, oh, look, I'm now actually, I'm doing the podcast, but also I'm flogging this again. And, you know, you'll have a sort of list of people that, well, no, don't go and see those.
Yes.
And you'll have a list of people who do. So just looking at the incumbents and how FS are changing and how some of those are making themselves more amenable, what do you think the key things are there?
I think the single biggest thing is that it's cultural. There's an awful lot of lip service paid to innovation and the adoption of innovation, the engagement with innovation. And I strongly believe that a huge amount of the industry rhetoric around that is incorrect. There is a three-stage process here: innovate, validate, adopt. At Illuminate, we've seen nearly 1,200 companies in the 3 years since we started the firm, and that is 1,200 companies that are only at the Series A or late seed capital markets fintech. So that's a niche within a niche. That, to me, demonstrates that there's more innovation out there than ever before. And of course, there are reasons for that, which we could go into. So the innovation is not the issue. The validation of that innovation is the issue.
And validation, just to be clear here,
that is making sure that people in your organization, whether you're a tier one bank, tier two, tier three, whether you're a large asset manager, insurance company, a hedge fund of any size, that people in your organization are encouraged, maybe even evaluated, on their receptivity to looking at new things and having an opinion on it. If you gave me the job as head of innovation of any major financial institution tomorrow, I would send out an email to anybody director level and above and say, spend 40 minutes a week evaluating new solutions that are relevant to your space. Send your thoughts to validate@megabank.com. And then we'll work out how to engage with it from there. What's actually happening, of course, is lots of fintech innovation labs, often in remote locations, miles away from the business. You know, some of those are more engaged than others. Some of them are completely empty. You've got the West Coast corporate tourism. Let's go over there and see what innovation looks like.
And they come away with superficial cultural characteristics like sort of, I don't know, not wearing suits, having ping pong tables and beanbags, which you can do innovation with that or wearing a bleeding suit and tie.
That's 100% right. And I think it's really important to remember that, you know, the culture that drives a SpaceX, Elon Musk wants to go to Mars. It's that simple. You've got a founder with a vision. Everybody else better get along for the ride. You cannot hope to replicate that culture in a 300-year-old financial institution that is being stewarded by its 28th CEO that in this day and age is going to have an average tenure of 4 to 6 years if he or she is lucky. It is a very different game. And it's also important to recognize that actually within capital markets, within financial services, the product's money. There's actually been an immense amount of innovation around the product.
Yes, yes. There's been too much innovation.
That's a separate subject for another podcast, Mike. But I think the question here is how we actually validate the enablers that actually support that product. So whether that's a pre-trade market discovery, whether that's a point-of-trade execution venue, whether that's post-trade processing, the compliance angles, trade surveillance, et cetera, et cetera. You know, validate those. If you don't validate those potential solutions, you don't get adoption. Without adoption, innovation dies, and it's like it never existed. And don't forget, Mike, we're at a moment in time where not only is there an unprecedented amount of innovation out there, right outside the factory gate, but actually there's an unprecedented number of problems that need solving as well.
Yes, from regulation, going back to the show with Lord Turner some time ago about how regulation has turned into micro-supervision, which just keeps mushrooming. But I really like, I mean, when I was looking at your website yesterday, I mean, we met about 3 years ago, and I think looked at a website then, but I really like this whole innovation, validation, adoption distinction, because it's not sufficiently run through in terms of people's understanding, and as we discussed, they go for the superficial. And again, going back to my experience of B2B sales to incumbents, the way that I'd always describe it was that I can have a meeting with you and I can talk to you and show you a PowerPoint and all that kind of stuff. And the best you would ever get out of that meeting is, in principle,
yes,
this is of interest.
Yes.
Well, I said, you're never going to be able to know whether in practice for you and your organisation, I don't know all your priorities, I don't know what your diary's like, da-di-da-di-da-di. You're never going to know in practice whether this is any good. So I'm a very slow learner and all that kind of stuff. And I eventually got around to the idea of doing a low price, very easy to sign off on, pilot study.
Yes.
And in my case, actually, just because I was using the management accounting data, there's a whole bunch of reasons around that. It's actually quite easy just to get that in a spreadsheet. I say, look, email me your data.
Yep.
I'll come back in a week's time with some charts about your business.
Yes. Yep.
If these charts tell you nothing you don't know, or put it a different way, if they don't show you something that actually you might find useful to show somebody else and explain something to them they've never got, fine. You know, I'll buy you a coffee sometime and let's keep in touch. Vice versa, if you look at these charts and go, do you know what? That's really useful. Well, then we should actually talk about taking it further. And it's really trying, I think, for many organisations, and this is B2B sales in general, forget FS as a whole, it's really trying to cross this, another chasm, cross a bridge from this is interesting in principle to this is interesting in practice. I mean, how do you see that gap? Is that part of your validation?
No, I think that's right. I think that's about validation. And again, it's also about culture. I have some very strong opinions on how large organisations in financial services approach pilots as well.
Oh, do tell me. I want strong opinions.
Well, I'm on a campaign for the paid pilot.
Right. Well, I worked that out because, I mean, I can say it now, it's so long ago, Standard Chartered is one of them. There was a really nice guy there, blah, blah, blah. I really enjoyed meeting him. It was really interesting meetings, that kind of stuff. And he said, well, we've got no budget. And I was so young and so stupid. I said, so I'd keep coming back and I'd do it for free. Well, it's like anything. If you give it away for free, people will have an infinite demand. It's only when there's a price. And the other thing I realised is that if you're doing a pilot for nothing, you haven't made any sale whatsoever.
Yes.
If I can't persuade you to give me $5,000 to come back and do a little bit of work, I actually haven't made the sale well enough in the first place. And, you know, I'm never going to get anywhere.
Yes. So I think there's a distinction in the language as well, right? A proof of concept is exactly that. So proof of concept might be free, but actually a pilot should be something that leads to production. That is the point of validation that there is value in your offering. Now, the large organizations that effectively should be commissioning those need to genuinely believe their own rhetoric in terms of, yes, we want to fire things up and fail fast, which is one of the cultural learnings learnings of all this West Coast corporate tourism.
Whereas in large mega cos of any sector in the entire world, you find almost nobody who wants to fail at all, let alone fail fast.
And that's the cultural problem. The other thing that those large companies tend to do is they tend to say to the small entrepreneur, you should do this for free, not because we don't value it, but because we're giving you the benefit of our IP and that's going to make you have a better product. And that is true. They fail to recognize the organizational asymmetry, and that again is the chasm between these multi-billion dollar companies that need solutions and the entrepreneurs that are ideating and originating the solutions that solve against them. When you do a pilot with a small company, you consume 100% of its IP, and you give up fractions of a fraction of a basis point of your own organizational IP. So there's an asymmetry there. To your point around the relative value and the fee, fees and revenue to small companies are worth more than the actual money. You can take the fact that you had a paid pilot to an investor and say, look, this is demonstrable traction. This is revenue. Yes, it's not massive, but we're coming out of the box. Now is the time. Get on board. Give us capital. Help us grow. You can't take a unpaid POC with anything like the same credibility for the same reasons that you outlined. So in fact, whether it's £10,000, $10,000, £20,000, £100,000, the quantum is almost less important than the fact that there is some demonstrable money and engagement on the table.
Yes, so I agree with everything you say, actually. So, sadly, I don't think it's sort of too controversial, or at least not too controversial amongst us. I mean, just trying to distill this into simple advice for senior folks in FS who might be listening to this, the thing that perhaps we're suggesting they consider is rather than setting aside some mega budget to innovate, because I actually think that everybody in every business around the world should every day be looking at how they need to change what they're doing.
Yes.
As part of the day job. One of the things I really dislike about how FS has gone in the last 20 years, although I've benefited from it in terms of consultancy gigs and that, is this distinction between BAU, as it's called, business as usual, and change management projects. That just didn't exist when I started. When I ran Global Fixed Interest Fund Management, my job was to keep the machine on the road and to change it as it needed to go along. And the distinction between the two has been very fatal. That's a different topic. But one thing we're suggesting here is that rather than setting up innovation labs, innovation budgets, or whatever, that we set up trial or validation or test budget.
Yes.
Okay, this year at Megabank, we're going to set aside $10 million and we're going to do 20 trials of stuff, whatever. Because you will get more from that, because as you started out saying, and I agree entirely, the deficit isn't in innovation, the deficit isn't in people with good ideas doing stuff. The deficit is in actually making it happen.
I think if you're spending $10 million a year on your innovation endeavors and you haven't ring-fenced at least $1 million of that money to spend on pilots where no one will get hung if nothing is ultimately delivered back to the business, then there is a flaw in your thinking about the innovation space. Now, again, some of those innovation labs are, they're called innovation labs, and they're about bringing those opportunities in and validating them. Some of them are about beanbags and petri dishes and lightning conductors. That's where the issue lies. One of our approaches in terms of what we tell our companies is, if you're funding 18 months or 24 months at a time, which is typically what you might be doing, certainly can't set up a set of vending relationships which are all on 24-month sales cycles and be dependent on any one of those. So finding ways to open up multiple conversations, finding ways to focus your sale on the incremental problem, which is a great problem to solve in a lab-type environment, as opposed to the displacement sale. Don't necessarily sell the disruption of, I'm going to replace your entire risk system.
I've met a couple of those firms. My advice was good luck, and they didn't get anywhere.
Sell the opportunity of, we're going to solve this incremental risk challenge that falls out of that regulation that has to be solved by that date, although, as we all know, even regulatory dates move, and land and expand from there.
Excellent. Well, I buy into all that. In a sense, it's not a surprise that we kind of in quite a lot of agreement on this, as you've got 20 years and I've got 30 years, a lot of which has been involved in systems because, you know, over the decades, the use of computers has only expanded in organisations and the need for them has only expanded. So maybe we can just dive in a little bit to the topology of capital markets fintechs, because just as all incumbents aren't the same thing within a circle and aren't identical, capital markets itself is a sort of a vast phrase, and you mentioned the different stages, pre-trade and post-trade and all that kind of stuff. How do you see it from where you're standing breaking down into, I don't know, does it make sense to say a subset of capital markets fintech is regulatory, or is that everything regulatory driven for the reasons you say at the moment?
I mean, RegTech is the new buzzword. I think RegTech is clearly a subset of fintech in the same way that capital markets is a subset of fintech as well. When I talk about capital markets fintech, I'm talking about two separate things. One is clear capital markets tech, right? If you're a collateral management platform like CloudMargin, you're not in the business of servicing supermarkets unless they've got derivatives that are collateralized. There are applications of tech, Duco in the reconciliation space. Reconciliation is clearly generic commerce tech. The reason that we would define a Duco as a capital markets fintech is because capital markets is the market that they're actually going after. So there's a nuance there. Then, of course, we bring RegTech into it. Well, CloudMargin is RegTech because it's addressing the variation margin challenges that people are about to have under EMIR and other legislation. Duco could also be argued to be RegTech or applicable against RegTech because of addressing MiFID II transaction reconciliation, amongst others. I think you can actually make an argument for RegTech being as large a subsector as you like.
Yes, this is a problem with using it as a buzzword because it can be everything at the moment.
But we tag every portfolio company that comes in on multiple vectors. Which business unit do you support? What business function do you support? What's your regulatory driver if there is one? And what other drivers are there? And I reckon around 60% of what we have in our database is pretty clearly RegTech in one way, shape or form.
I see. That's an interesting interpretation of the phrase. I was called recently by Newsweek, actually, and I'd given them some advice in the past about an AI conference, breaking all my rules in the book by doing it sort of unpaid anyway. They were so happy with their advice for free, they called me for some more free advice, at which point I pointed out, well, maybe I shouldn't keep doing it for free. But they were asking about RegTech, and I'd kind of taken a narrower interpretation of the phrase at the time, and I said, well, there's a massive potential, but it's really hard to name a firm, for example, that will make a massive dent on the 4,500 compliance officers that HSBC needs in London. I entirely agree that from a sort of pragmatic basis, and it's how I do it, you need to slice off the sort of the challenges at the moment and do this subparagraph of that regulation that needs to be done by Christmas, otherwise you'll never get anywhere. But separately, maybe one of the challenges for some of these firms is that pragmatism leads you down the incrementalism route. And therefore, there is no kind of Elon Musk of RegTech, which says, Mark, I've got a solution for you, and that's going to get rid of you. 90% of your compliance officers. You know, I make that kind of sell, someone's going to listen in FS. So is there that kind of tension?
I think you identify something. I'm not sure if it's a tension, but I was actually talking to the CTO suite of one of our bank partners only yesterday, and I used this exact example. If you look at fintech based on what you read in the press, it is all blockchain and now increasingly AI. In reality, less than 1% of the money that got allocated to fintech last year got allocated to blockchain, but I feel like 50% of the column inches got allocated to it. No one in financial services woke up this morning and said, I need more AI, right? AI is just tech. Lots of people woke up this morning and said, how are we going to address both the control and cost issue that was created over the last decade that resulted from us having to hire 4,000 more compliance officers? Now, the answer to solving that problem may well be a cloud-delivered trade surveillance as a service, utilizing all manner of AI to analyze trades, to process the results, and to visualize them. That is a great use of AI, but it really comes down to what I think we're all about, certainly at Illuminate, which is fundamentally, we're not a technology investor at all, right? Or if we are a technology investor,
It's a means to an end.
Right. We're a technology investor second. We are a business solutions investor first. We live in a moment of generational change within capital markets. That means generational change within infrastructure for capital markets. Back to your point about BAU versus change the bank. The mandatory change agenda is larger than it's ever been. And it's driven by cost, it's driven by control, it's driven by capital, and it's driven by compliance, right? None of those things prescribe a certain type of technology, but there are lots of interesting potential applications of certain types of technologies to address all of them. That's what excites us.
Yes, that makes a lot of sense. And I mean, you know, going back to this disjoint, going back to Russell Brand last night, he was talking about the fact that he'd been immensely criticised in the media, and he'd been mainstream media, and he's been very critical of the mainstream media. And then he said, funnily enough, he said, I find it's really hard to get a job in media. He said, I'm starting to see how this works. Yeah. So I'm not quite sure why the media does what the media does, but in terms of the tech side of it, well, actually, I do know what the media does, what the media does. It's selling column inches and adverts. But the kind of tech focus you're talking about is supply push. There were these technologies floating around in search of a killer use case, but it hasn't existed. Whereas the demand pull side is precisely what you say. Look, I've got this headache. I run this business, correct, Mark. I've got this headache. Can you help my headache? Don't care how you help it. You know. And I was about to give an analogy, but it wouldn't work with someone like you, which is like almost like it doesn't matter what's under the bonnet of a car as long as it does what you want. But actually, someone like you, that probably fails.
It matters
immensely.
A great deal.
Yes,
it
exactly.
Matters a great deal.
Now I've got a V24 under my bonnet.
But I think you raise a very good point. And fortunately for them, my team aren't in this room with us. But if they've heard me say it once, they've heard me say it 1,000 times, right? When we talk about the 4 C's, cool technology is not one of our C's, right? We live in a world where large financial markets institutions will ignore cool technology until the cows come home, right? But they cannot ignore their problems.
Yes, which reminds me actually that I do know one of the reasons for this, which is that if you're in tech, I used to have a sort of sales pack, a marketing pack around Stratos. And one of the points that I made, but eventually it fell out because no one gave a damn, was that I'm deliberately using old technology, having started my life in software business. So I did my system, which did earn 7 figures and did get an offer for the company. I wrote it in Visual Basic, which in the 90s was so old hat. But because of my deep background in IT, I knew the best thing you could do is use old hat technology.
Yes.
Because otherwise, 90% of your life is solving the bleeding edge problems with a certain technology.
Yes.
No one gives a monkey's. The banks have got enough problems with that. So we've covered a hell of a lot of ground there, and I hope that sort of, you know, these thoughts are useful both for startups and fintechs trying to get into incumbents. Actually, a lot of these points apply outside FS, not just in FS, and also ways for mega banks, insurance companies, et al., to think about their challenge differently. And as I say, I love your idea of innovation versus validation adoption. Before we dive into Illuminate a little bit more, Mark, and what you guys are up to and what you want more of, I'd like to thank all the listeners out there. It's always good to hear from you, and there would be no point in the show if you weren't there. I'd also like to thank my brand partners for the podcast, Archover, smart, simple, and transparent P2P business lending. Loans up to £3 million for SMEs, delivering up to 7% secured and insured returns to lenders. Smart Pension, who are fast, secure, and free. Check out their UK workplace pensions at autoenrolment.co.uk. Synchron, digital business consulting and technology services for top-tier FS. From startup to 7,000 people, 18 countries and $400 million of revenue. So narrowing in from capital markets, fintech, to Illuminate Financial, what is in Shoreditch, what are you doing at the moment, Mark? Where are you going? And if I was your fairy godmother and I could wave my magic wand 3 times and not wearing a tutu, what wishes do you have at the moment?
Well, thank you. So we closed our fundraising for our first fund in October 2016. We have 17 LPs, 15 of whom come from the sector. Our model is very much to be not just money to the companies that we invest in, but to really offer sector leverage to help them come to market, precisely because it is such a difficult arena to make sales in. And the advantage of network is huge. So we have 3 multi-billion dollar corporates within our LP base who care about that next emerging group of market structure. And we also have 4 strategic bank partners, Deutsche Bank, UBS, Barclays, and ING, who we share our pipeline with, to help them find potential solutions, not from our portfolio, although obviously we're happy when they want those ones, but from our pipeline to address the many problems that they face day to day in their businesses. And this really kind of comes down to, you know, what we're doing at Illuminate, which is fundamentally pretty simple. There are only three stakeholder groups within fintech, and we try to sit at the heart of them and create a virtuous environment where everybody benefits. We have a pipeline, a very strong pipeline of capital markets fintechs. We saw 200 new companies come through the door in Q1 of this year alone. We have a pipeline of fintech consumers, so the banks, the smaller banks, the asset managers, the buy side. And we have ultimately those people, those individuals, family offices, financial institutions, pension funds, asset managers that want to deploy capital against fintech or indeed against capital markets fintech in particular. We sit at the heart of that ecosystem, connecting the dots in a way that is more than just money and governance, delivering value to all of our stakeholders, interestingly, including the pipeline of fintechs. A company can come to Illuminate and get connectivity to our investors or connectivity to our strategic bank partners or our partners on the asset management and buy side without us ever actually investing a dollar. That then feeds back to us because, of course, they then go back to their WeWork spaces and say, hey, we met somebody that not only understands Dodd-Frank, but actually connected us to this bank as well. So it's a virtuous environment. If you're in one of those three groups of people, you offered me three wishes. I've only got three sets of stakeholders. Please reach out to Illuminate. We're always interested in making new contacts within any part of that network because ultimately we are a network business ourselves and it's mutually beneficial.
Absolutely, and that's very clear. And I can see that the facilitation is absolutely invaluable. I mean, if I rebooted my approach to strategic management information, which is very possible because no one's actually gone down the top-down route to examining risk in businesses, then it would be impossible to do now, ironically, because everyone was going on about how it's much easier than it was. But actually, it would be impossible to do now what I did 20 years ago because of how the industry has changed.
Yes.
I would absolutely need a partner like yourself. I would absolutely not be able to do what I did then, which is sit in an office in Regis on my own and just call people.
Yes.
And make stuff happen for all the reasons we've been talking about. So it's really vital to have somebody such as yourselves. And it's immensely clear to me, and I'm sure to the listeners, that not only do you know of what you speak, but you've sort of lived it and breathed it and are living it and breathing it. And just on the fund, I need to ask, I mean, so how big is the fund and how much of it is it spent?
Okay, so we are a £35 million fund. We had a £35 million target and that's what we raised. We're in deployment mode right now. We've made four investments. We're closing two right now and have a couple in DD behind that. So, you know, we have plenty to go.
Right. Excellent. Well, as you say, there's plenty of other subjects here, which would be an entire podcast on their own. But I think the entire podcast on its own topic, which we won't dive into now, is how on earth you cope with 1,000 suitors knocking on your door. It may sound like a great thing to have sort of 1,000 people of the opposite sex or of the kind of thing that you want to invest in knocking on the door, but that must be a hell of a lot of speed dating involved in getting through 1,000 people.
Luckily, I employ a lot of people and they're a lot smarter than I am. So as with anything, it's about having a machine that can actually process what comes in at the top.
Excellent. Well, it's 3 years since I met you, Mark, and you've done immensely well since then and are clearly very focused. And what I particularly like is that in a very complex world, you've really sort of nailed down the elements which are necessary because, going back to these change management projects, Keep It Simple Stupid works immensely well. And so many times I've joined gigs and everyone's talking about X, Y, and Z. You know, how do they do the last 50 feet of sort of the Hillary step? Most of them haven't got their bloody passport and know where Heathrow is. You know, if you do A and B really well, then generally you don't even need to get to C because actually that's sort of, you know, quite effective. The same thing happens in martial arts as well, actually, but it's another topic entirely. So I wish you every success in the next 3 years and I hope you get lots more suitors of all the natures that you want and you marry them all off. So thank you for that, Mark.
Many thanks. I really, really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening. If you have consulting, advisory / non-exec, or media needs in the FS or fintech space, get in touch with me at mike@londonfintechpodcast.com. We could
sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. Come away from the city, but with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so gray, with the pain of the the mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me, 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 watch the firelight dance.